This is GabFest Radio, a weekly program about politics and culture from Slate and WNYC. On this week's political GabFest, the sequester looms. Can $85 billion in federal budget cuts be stopped? And who'll take the blame if they aren't?
Changes like this affect our ability to respond to threats in unstable parts of the world.
Also, the showdown between the White House and the press over a presidential round of golf. I'm David Plotz.
And I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Culture GabFest, Kindling Quarterly, a new Brooklyn-based magazine about fatherhood. Must you have period facial hair to appreciate it? And then the Oscar-nominated documentary Searching for Sugar Man, about how an American musician you've never heard of became a sensation in South Africa. And finally, the new HBO documentary about Beyoncé, produced and directed by Beyoncé.
I'm a human being. I cry. I get scared. I get nervous, just like everyone else.
We'll start with the political GabFest right after the news.
Hello and welcome to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. I'm David Plotz in Washington. On this week's show, we'll talk about the looming sequester and whether it can be avoided and who will be blamed for it. And then, why is the White House press corps complaining about Obama's golf game? Joining me today are Slate's chief political correspondent, John Dickerson, here in Washington. Hello, John.
Hello, David.
And from Toronto, Canada, fresh off the smash start to her book tour. Her new book is Sticks and Stones. Emily was awesome on Fresh Air and on Colbert this week. Emily Bazelon, Slate senior editor. Hello, Emily.
Hello, David. Thank you.
So we are not going to talk about any congressional love children this week, even though there are two new ones since we last met. We're not going to talk about any members of Congress going to jail, although one member of Congress is going to jail since we last met.
They've been so busy over there at the Capitol.
So instead, we're going to talk about the politics of the sequester. Is the sequester going to happen? If it does, why? What will it do? Who will take the blame for it? Barring an incredibly unlikely last-minute compromise, the federal government will start undergoing a series of automatic cuts at the end of next week. The cuts will hit discretionary defense spending and discretionary domestic spending. Will hit Medicare. Known as the sequester, the $85 billion in cuts are the outcome, you will remember, of the ridiculous 2011 debt ceiling showdown, which then led to the super committee showdown, which then led to the they pushed it forward. It was supposed to happen on January 1st. That led to the fiscal cliff showdown, which led to the sequester, these automatic cuts being pushed forward to March 1st, 2013, where they will apparently take place. John, is there any possibility there's going to be a deal on this before March 1st?
I think it is pretty unlikely before March 1st, but in one of the dreary parts of these serial crisis moments or faux crisis moments is gauging how much the deadlines are really the deadlines. And in this case, March 1st isn't really a super hard deadline. There are measures that can be, you know, catastrophe will not ensue on March 2nd. So there's some more wiggle room. I think that something will have to be done at some point, because if this were to go on for 7 months, you would have a real effect on people's lives, on the economy. There would actually be damage. The question is when the real damage would kick in and what then, therefore, is the real deadline. And what you probably would have is a little short deal, and then they'd go back to the bigger attempt to try and reconcile the two vastly different positions on how to budget the federal government. But at least they'd have a little time to do it if they did another one of these snooze bar, kick the can down the road agreements, which is the only way I see this getting resolved in the short term.
The cuts would hit. There would be a lot to sort of discretionary defense spending. So not the things which involve troops being deployed and getting paid, but things like weapon systems, civilians in the Pentagon. There will be a lot of cuts to Head Start, to Medicare, huge cuts to scientific research, to the CDC, to immigration enforcement, to border security. Emily, are these bad sets of cuts? Are these particularly disastrous? I mean, if the federal budget deficit is huge, maybe these cuts should take place.
Well, isn't the wisdom that, yes, we need cuts, but these are dumb cuts because they're across the board. They're not thought through. It's not about cutting waste. It's just about cutting percentages. I mean, that makes sense to me. On the other hand, I have to say I understand why the Republicans are holding firm this time, because they constantly feel like cuts get kicked the can down the road, and here is an opportunity to actually realize some cuts of some kind. So even if you just think of it as a social experiment, I know we're not supposed to play games with people's lives and that the real pain will be inflicted, but on the other hand, you can see why from their point of view this is so appealing.
Right. John, I remember you made this point very vividly, I think it was at a live show perhaps 2 years ago, where you talked about this fact that why Republicans were so reluctant to take any tax increases is because they say the spending cuts that are supposed to accompany them never happen. It is a key idea, right, John, is that this is a chance to get something that sticks.
Right, and something that they never get in any other real fashion. And they don't believe the president says he cut $1.2 trillion. They don't believe it. In some ways, they only believe cuts when people freak out. And so the freaking out is, in a sense, a validation of the size of these cuts. The reason the cuts are dumb is, A, they're across the board. B, they are painful. They are causing a lot of angst. But they are still for a portion of the budget that isn't the really painful portion of the budget that we really need to deal with, which is long-term healthcare costs. And so basically you're refusing to eat breakfast, but you're still having an enormous dinner. And so you're having this huge fight.
That's how I live, by the way. I don't eat breakfast, but I have an enormous dinner.
Aren't you supposed to do the reversal?
I think it's actually, you can extend the metaphor. It's as if you refuse to eat yogurt or granola for breakfast, and then you have a huge cupcakes and ice cream sundae for dinner.
Well,
which you wouldn't do that.
Except that the metaphor in my construction is you don't eat anything at all, because the level of pain, and whether the pain is real or not, everybody is talking about it, although there's even that's cutting kind of funny now. People are talking about it as being this huge cut and painful, and it's not really as painful as some people are talking about would be necessary to get the budget on a path towards having a lower share of GDP, but it's also not painful relative to the real tough choices that people believe have to be made to long-term health costs to get those in line so that they don't really cripple the budget because of healthcare inflation and the booming population.
And then if you're like me, you actually – even though I agree with you intellectually, Emily, that I can understand why Republicans want this, they are in fact, in my view, completely intellectually wrong, that this is not a time when government should be cutting spending at all. In fact, given that we can borrow at essentially 0%, given that the country has terrible bleeding infrastructure and huge unemployment, and the private sector isn't creating jobs at the rate we would wish it was, this is a time when government should spend a huge amount and make investments in things that will pay off in the long term, like big investments in infrastructure and energy technology and education, and spend a lot and spend us out of this recession, which will never, ever happen. But in fact, we're doing exactly the opposite. That's not to say I don't understand why Republicans want these cuts. I do.
Right. But the argument you're making, I think of as the convincing Paul Krugman point, right? He's been saying this for years, and it's just it makes sense, but it's not intuitive. If you feel like you have this huge looming deficit, the notion that you're going to spend your way out of it in the short term is hard to quite believe.
A couple more reasons Republicans are against this. I mean, there are those who just want any kind of cutting, and that's fine. But those who are against it argue a version of what Democrats argue, which is, yes, we want cuts, but we want smart cuts that allow growth to happen. And these are just dumb cuts that don't – you get the pain of the cut, but you're not doing it smartly, so you don't get – any kind of you limit the amount of kinds of benefits you get,
right, and the you second don't get the benefit of the growth later,
right, and also you get the people who are the defense hawks who don't want to mess with the Defense Department and would rather cut other things. So that's where you have Republicans being against this as well.
I want to talk about this, a little bit about the politics of it. So over the past dreadful several years, the Republicans and Democrats, or really House Republicans and President Obama, have faced off repeatedly over fiscal matters. So there's been debt ceiling showdowns. There's been government shutdown, there's sort of a budget resolution, government shutdown threats. There have been the fiscal cliff, the Bush tax cuts showdown. And now we have this sequester showdown. Why is it that this is the one Republicans are willing to let happen? Why politically is this the one that's okay to happen? They didn't want a debt ceiling. They didn't want to lose that. They weren't willing to let all the Bush tax cuts expire. They weren't willing to to actually put the government into shutdown before. Why is this the one that they can do politically, Emily?
Well, I think it's telling that in a poll, only 36% of Americans understood what sequestration was. So I think Republicans could reasonably believe that they're not going to get blamed for this because it's confusing and no one quite understands what led up to this, what concessions have been made by either side, why we're in this fix. And so it seems of all of the various scenarios, the least likely for the Republicans in the House to just get completely slammed for it. And that seems crucial. Once that's true, why would they agree to it?
It's very confusing because you have conflicting Republican views because there are both for two different reasons. One, there are Republicans who believe different things, and then there are Republicans who are having to shift their views because on the one hand, they have to say this sequester is horrible and it's Obama's idea. Now, if that doesn't stick, they have to then say the sequester isn't so horrible because if it comes into being and they get blamed, they don't want to get blamed with something that's horrible. So it's very hard to keep your eye on the bouncing ball here. I think the reason – the other cuts, the other things, the debt limit and the fiscal cliff and the taxes would have been worse for the Republicans politically and I think they think economically. In other words, if all of your taxes go up, if everybody's taxes go up, more pain. This case, the people who will be affected, government workers and stuff.
Also, going back to the point you were making at the beginning, John, which is that all these other ones, the debt ceiling, would have put the U.S. into complete default. The taxes all go up at once. The government shutdown shuts down the government.
Right.
This is something which is going to be – it's going to cause damage, but it's going to cause damage in a nibbling way. It will nibble at us, and then we'll wake up in November and realize we've lost some points off GDP. And actually, then the president kind of owns the problem because,
exactly.
because it's the economy that's suffering.
Right. Then you succeeded in blowing a hole in the tires of the economy, and that could be really good for the Republicans in 2014.
I think that's right. I think you have two things also. This is the third in the first fiscal cliff, then debt limit, now this fight. And Republicans who gave in on those other two and were considered to have been basically, you know, taken by the president would be – if there were to be an agreement here, they'd probably have to agree to some kind of revenue, which would be another capitulation. They can't do three capitulations in a row without having a total revolt. And I think that point about the economy is really important. In the short term, Republicans are getting killed in the polls. The approval rating for the president is above 50%. It's about 25% for Republicans in Congress. The Pew Center came out with a poll that showed basically Republicans, a majority of Republicans agree with the president's mix of revenues and cuts. But that's – so in the short term, the president has the high hand. But as Emily said, we tend to think of economies by the presidencies. And so in 10 years, when you talk about the Obama economy, if it is weak and made weaker by the sequester, then the president is the one who is remembered for all time as having been dealt a bad hand and not really improved it too terribly much. And somebody will then come along and say, yes, but he had a tough Congress. But that's kind of the second sentence.
It's like the asterisk, right? Yeah. It's not the main – it's not the headline.
Right. And the sequester is supposed to take 0.6% off GDP, so less than 1%. But that's enough. That's enough to really be a drag. It isn't enough to crater everything. It's just enough to, you know, not even shoot the tires out, Emily. It's kind of to let the air out of the tires.
And we should
it's
just
kind
point
of perfect, isn't it?
Well, it's perfect. But that kind of ascribes malign intent to the Republicans. Right. Republicans don't actually want the American economy to tank. I mean, they have political interests, which they want to gain politically. But ultimately, Republican politicians want America to thrive and prosper, too.
Sure. I'm not suggesting it's entirely cynical. I'm just thinking that if you feel like the answer are government cuts and you see a way to impose them where you don't, A, have to pass a law, and B, you're not causing some total stranglehold on the economy, it does seem like that's the moment when you would roll the dice on this.
It should be noted that the Congressional Budget Office said that if these were to go forward, that the U.S. would not get back to its potential growth till 2017. To put that in perspective, we will have gone through an entire other presidential campaign by then.
Oh, lordy, lordy. Coming up, why are White House reporters so angry at the president about golf? You're listening to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is GabFest Radio. I'm David Plotz along with Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, and this is the political GabFest portion of the show. You'll find links for much of what we discussed on GabFest Radio and a place to leave your comments on our show page, wnyc.org/GabFest. Let's move on to our next topic. President Obama, lucky ducky, played golf twice this weekend, which is two times more than I got to play golf, once with big donors and once privately with Tiger Woods. The Tiger Woods outing ignited a ridiculous but impassioned debate in the White House press corps because reporters were barred from the course and given no access to the president, which seemed to have infuriated them. And they see it, some of these White House reporters see it as just one more example of the White House overlooking them, sidelining them. President Obama has been made available to the press only a third as much as President Bush was over the same time period, I think.
Impressed with formal
– I think it's now informal ways. And then he's done 35 press conferences, but some of them haven't been in prime time, although why that matters, it doesn't seem to matter at all. And he almost never – essentially never gives private interviews to newspapers. New York Times and Washington Post haven't had a sit-down interview with him in a very, very, very long time. He really only does it with TV and sometimes with friendly local media. So, John, you were a White House reporter for many years. You know this beat. You know what the job is. Is this a fight in which the White House reporters have any legs to stand on?
You know, in a sense, they always do because administrations are always trying to limit the access of reporters and support reporters' jobs to be singular in pushing for access in all cases and all instances. And on the one hand, you can think, well, geez, let the president play his golf, which is fine. To not tell the White House press corps when you have an agreement to tell them is not great. And secondly, it's not really about golf. It's about President Bush was reading a book to school children when we were attacked on 9/11. So weird stuff happens during a presidency, and you need to have a press pool that's around in case anything weird happens, not to cover the golf match. There is a penchant, though, for whininess from all of us in the press, and sometimes it gets a little overdone. I think this is just like the natural state of things, basically. They try and limit it and we whine about it, and it's not unnatural and it's not really that surprising.
So, Emily, do you think this reflects some sort of unseemliness on the part of the press, that they should just shut up?
What I find disappointing, although not surprising, is that this is what we're talking about instead of the fact that the White House has kept the legal memos that justify its drone program a secret. I mean, that is really something we need everybody to chew over, and the New York Times and other news organizations, I think, have brought FOIA requests in order to get those documents and been denied, and the Obama administration won't even let congressional aides look at them. They haven't fully disclosed them to Congress. I mean, that seems to me like the much more substantive, real, timely debate to be having. And instead, we're arguing about how the Golf Channel lady got into the – or was it a lady? Anyway, the Golf Channel reporter got into the golf game instead of everyone else.
Of course, you're right. I think we have been doing both. I mean, there was a pretty good amount of coverage of the drone memos. I mean, we talked about it here as well. I think – so I'm not sure it's been gone totally uncovered, and I know that wasn't exactly your argument. The problem
You can exaggerate my point.
Yeah, I know. Well, at least I acknowledge
that away.
At least I acknowledge that I was exaggerating it. The problem, which I would agree with, is that basically, like, the amount of talk this got from, because it's basically reporters love to talk about themselves. I think there is a brokenness with the White House beat, though, that is hard to fix, but it's broken because when you're a White House reporter for any institution, you got to cover every darn little thing the White House does. And so even if the White House puts out a small, meaningless statement, you've got to be on it. And that ties you down like Gulliver. I mean, you just can't move, which means – I mean, you can't move because the news organization doesn't let you move. And that's what kills you. And the White House knows that, and they know how to kill you like that. And it would be great if basically news organizations said, you know what, we're just going to like let somebody else cover that stuff and we're going to let our White House reporters be enterprising. And the problem then is that that it's hard to crack physically. When you cover the Hill, you can stop people in the hallways. Really hard to do in the White House because it's also walled off. You have access to like two rooms. To go see anybody physically, you have to be granted access and physical access. And that is just one of the many problems with covering the White House.
Yeah, I mean, to me,
I would hate that beat so much.
A friend of mine was not long ago offered a White House correspondence job for a very good place, and she was asking about it, and I was just saying, don't do it. Don't do it. Don't do it. You will hate yourself. The hours will be ridiculous, and you'll be nibbled to death by ducks. You do terrible things. Slate has made a conscious decision basically not to have somebody sit in that room all the time because it just doesn't seem like anything comes out of it that's interesting. Where the interesting White House stories come out tend to be from people who are tangential to it, who are askew to it.
I think that people should assign White House reporters and then obligate them to do nothing that the White House kind of gives them. In other words, cover the White House however you want. So, you know, for example, the president has a staged performance with first responders behind him. You don't have to cover that. Go write about, you know, some other aspect of the White House and, you know, and we'll just bank – we'll make this bet. And the bet is basically that people care more about what a White House does than what they do, you know, substantively than what they do with their showiness. And, you know, that would include not covering the State of the Union speech. You could just, you know, find ways to cover a White House that would leave the –
well, this is effectively what you do.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, this is like doing an advertisement for your job.
Sometimes we all sometimes fall into ceremony, both because it's useful and because it's appointment journalism, and we all like moments where we can schedule something and we know there's going to be a big event that we can pay attention to.
Yeah.
It's not right. You wouldn't get rid of it entirely, even maybe though you should.
No, that's absolutely true. But the other problem too is that the appointment stuff gets covered, you know, and like you can go write your piece about the non-story of the day, but guess what? People are reading what's happening in the story of the day, and this baloney back and forth on the budget, like people are obsessed about that, even though it's incredibly frustrating and it doesn't help anybody. It gets a lot of people watching and talk about it. And so then you wonder, well, wait a minute, if people are watching and talking about it, why am I not engaging in this argument?
But it kind of depends. I mean, there are news organizations, many news organizations, which feel like we have an obligation to be on top of every last burp and fart of that because we're a comprehensive news organization. But I mean, if you think about it, there's the New York Times in the newspapers, New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, USA Today, a billion small papers. There are four networks, seven plus CNN plus like I don't even know. There are probably a whole bunch of other networks already that, you know, the wire services. That's a dozen major places that are all basically saying we're going to cover this tiny meaningless thing because we have to. But that's 11 too many.
Yeah.
Why can't there be one – not just a pool for – whether the president goes golfing, but a pool for all of
just
that.
For everything the White House puts
all
out.
All ceremony, the pool. All press releases covered by a pool.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, and that's essentially what the White House has done, is that by having access to the web, the White House, and this was the subject of a Politico article, that the White House has learned a new level of manipulation. I think that every White House tries to do this, which is to say use technology to make a direct connection with people. So people can connect to the White House website. They can see pictures released by the White House, as opposed to in the old days, you'd have photographers doing the pictures, which means framing the White House as it is, as opposed to the White House releases pictures that obviously put the president in the perfect light and create a tableau of his presidency that's totally manipulating people. And so you want photographers to be around to capture that in a way that actually photographers can do. And so you would have to find some kind of balance. But it's just a lot of man hours could be freed up to do other kinds of reporting.
Indeed. That'll do it for the Political Gabfest portion of the show. You'll find a longer version of the show with more topics at slate.com/podcasts. I'm David Plotz in Washington. The Culture Gabfest starts right now.
I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest. On today's show, Life is But a Dream, a documentary on HBO about the singer Beyoncé Knowles, and then Kindling Quarterly, a new magazine about fatherhood. And finally, the Oscar-nominated documentary Searching for Sugar Man. Joining me today is Slate's deputy editor, Julia Turner. She's joining us remotely. Hello, Julia.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. How are you?
Great.
And of course, Slate's film critic, Dana Stevens. Hey, Dana.
Hey, Steve.
All right. Well, the much-anticipated HBO documentary, Life is But a Dream, about Beyoncé, is now available on demand on HBO. It's been airing the past week, and we decided to talk about it. It has not been met with a chorus of approval, Julia Turner. And I'm going to say outright, you made me watch this documentary. So I start bailing water.
Justify your love, Julia.
Because this ship is
of all, this was Dana's idea, so I didn't even want to hear that from you, Dana. Second of all, Steve, you were like totally psyched when I told you that Dana and I were forcing you to watch this documentary.
I've never been totally psyched
in my life, so we can falsify that
I could hear total psychness coming through the phone. When
He was 75% psyched once.
I'm going to have to learn how to drip with contempt a little better, apparently. But very quickly, let's just say, as a way of setting it up, a no chorus of approval, quite the opposite. It's been called nothing but a theatrical infomercial, a cog in the machinery of divahood. But why don't we listen to a clip to give our listeners a taste?
I always battle with, how much do I reveal about myself? How do I keep my humility? How do I keep my spirit and the reality? And how do I continue to be generous to my fans and to my craft? And how do I stay current, but how do I stay soulful? And it is the battle of my life.
Okay, so the first thing to know about this documentary is that it was produced and, according to the credits, directed by Beyoncé, also starring Beyoncé and about Beyoncé. And the second thing you need to know is that it is a completely execrable production. It is, I have seldom watched something so bad, I think. It just reveals nothing about her. And it's sort of fascinating in its badness because it is like an up-close vision of the celebrity striptease of trying to seem like they're showing you something without actually showing you anything at all.
Mm-hmm.
Did you guys find it equally opaque and unrevealing?
Yeah, Dana, what do you think?
Even for something of this sort, I mean, this is the self-produced pop star documentary is something we've even talked about before. We went to the Justin Bieber concert movie and we talked about Katy Perry. Those mm-hmm. are both somewhat along the same lines, right? They're long infomercials for the pop star. But you're right, Julie, that this one takes it to a new level, in part because Beyoncé is the auteur, the self-described, you know, master of everything that's going on. Also, of course, that she's known for her privacy and her classiness and all of these kind of Beyoncé qualities that she puts on display in this very coy and teasing way. The Jay-Z reveal, for example, the first mention of the fact that he exists or glimpse of his face happens about half an hour in. There's no interview with him. He never says a word, essentially, except sort of a little bit of background mumbling as we see him wandering through. And then even more hilarious is the Blue Ivy reveal in the last few minutes of the documentary where the baby is handed to Beyoncé for maybe about 20 seconds and then taken off screen again.
Yeah. I mean, it's as if this movie were the result of a focus group that went into everything that one is inclined not to like about Beyoncé, right? That she's overproduced, manufactured, inhuman, remote, and less interesting than her impresario partner, Jay-Z. So what do? They depict her very often as alone, in crisis, reflective, and very self-directed as an artist, right? And you walk away believing absolutely none of these things. In fact, you walk away with any impression you have of her as a relatively empty show business phenomenon, utterly reinforced, to my mind, at least.
Well, you don't come away thinking she's self-directed as an artist. I mean, if there's one thing that I came away thinking, it's that she's immensely powerful and has a huge amount of control over her image.
I suppose so. But I mean, I guess she makes the mistake at one point in the documentary of invoking Nina Simone, right? As the ideal, she is complaining, Beyoncé is complaining about the fact that the music business has changed unalterably. It's now dominated by very quick hit. It's an internet experience, a shuffle play experience, and what used to be true of the music business, which is that a serious recording artist had a body of work and a career, is hardly possible anymore. And the only agent who's going to make that possible for Beyoncé Knowles is Beyoncé Knowles. That's the theme of this vanity project, right? I'm susceptible to the argument that that is the historic change of the music business, and therefore we don't get, you know, serious artists who cultivate a kind of, you know, persona and a body of work over a long, you know, duration of time. I didn't walk away believing for one second that she's the antidote to this. In fact, the movie reinforces her as the absolute apotheosis of everything she claims is wrong with the music business, right? It's shallow, quick hit, boring, rooted in images, shallow images, overproduced, and ultimately remote and inhuman. I mean, I thought over and over again, the point of this documentary was to make this person seem less like an airbrushed showbiz royalist, and it did not work.
Yeah, I agree. There were some snatches of a more interesting Beyoncé within it that made me feel like I would have liked to see a documentary about Beyoncé by a real director with an interesting perspective. I loved seeing her at work. Like, I liked when she was, you know, showing up for rehearsing, directing, and preparing for these kind of extravaganza stage show performances at the Billboard Awards or the Grammys. and how she worked with her team and her choreographers and how exacting she was about the lighting design and the background video. I mean, she's a woman with strong opinions who's managing a huge core of people. And the other thing that's so interesting that came through in it to me is she points out that she started dating Jay-Z when she was 20, which is crazy. I didn't realize she had been so young. And there's so much in her self-assessment that seems so naive and kind of high schoolish. Like, she's always taking these selfie webcam videos with her laptop, if the documentary is to be believed. She's like on the road pouring her heart out to her MacBook in the middle of the night with artfully arranged hair and sort of trying to make herself kind of look cute and vulnerable the way you see teen girls doing on Facebook. I mean, it just, she seemed so naive and simple. and the combination between that girl and the woman who was sort of the boss of these extravaganzas is kind of still fascinating to me. I just, and my fascination is not quenched in any way by this particular documentary.
I agree with you, Julia. My fascination and my actual admiration for her as a performer is not quenched. It's not my kind of music that Beyoncé sings, but there's no question at all that she's a phenomenal performer, a phenomenal singer and dancer. And so those brief clips that you see her on stage, or as Julia says, putting her stage show together, did give me the impression that there was a real artist at work. But whoever put this documentary together seems to be in an entirely different business of obscuring what's going on.
I find that her music is capable of eliciting emotions in me. I find some of it resonant. I like some of those songs. I think Countdown, her song, is like one of the great odes to marriage and pop music. People don't write those that much. It's a terrific song, and she gets at stuff in her music that is real and is emotional. There's more to her than there is to Katy Perry, I think, or to some of the other pop flashes we've talked about on the show.
All right, well, we need to move on. And that documentary, once again, is on HBO. It's probably on HBO on demand if you missed it at its original broadcast. It's called Life is But a Dream. It's the story of and by the singer Beyoncé Knowles. Coming up, the Oscar-nominated documentary Searching for Sugar Man. It's remarkable, but is it totally true? You're listening to Gabfest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is Gabfest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf, along with Dana Stevens and Julia Turner, and this is the Culture Gabfest portion of the show. One reminder, you can always find links to the things we discuss on the program at our show page, wnyc.org/gabfest. All right, moving on to our next topic. Paternity may be a legal fiction, so wrote James Joyce in Ulysses, a sentence that has stuck with me, in part because it's in contrast to another interesting, provocative statement in James Joyce's Ulysses, that the only thing Stephen Dedalus believes in as a transcendent value is motherhood. And I actually think that that's an interesting, Dana Stevens, sort of an interesting way of looking at the relationship between fatherhood and motherhood, that without motherhood, there's nothing, right? There's no species whatsoever. I mean, children need to be nurtured. And fatherhood is a social construct, you know, rooted as all human things are in our biology. But something of it needs to be made and filtered through the culture. To that end, we now live in a period of slow food, slow learning, slow everything. There's now a magazine devoted to what could be called slow fatherhood. It's called Kindling Quarterly, that aims to, according to it, quote, present a thoughtful dialogue about fatherhood that is missing from our cultural landscape. So, Dana Stevens, I've thrown a huge incoherent jumble at you. You must now pick through it and say something. Now, let me phrase it as a real question, which is Do you agree that there is an absence, or at least a sufficient absence, of thoughtful fatherhoodness or dialogue or public discourse about being a father, that something like this is necessary? And then what did you make of the actual product itself?
Well, I'm still stuck on your implication that motherhood is not as much of a social construct as fatherhood is.
To James Joyce.
Take it to James.
Take it up with JJ, baby. Not my problem.
But as to your second point, yeah, the idea that a fatherhood magazine has never existed, which is what the makers of Kindling Quarterly are at least claiming, if true, is somewhat shocking. And it seems like it is a niche that needs to be filled. Whether this particular magazine is going to be the thing to fill it is another question. And especially given that at this moment in publishing, they're deciding to make this very expensive, very designy, print-only magazine, seems a little bit like a doomed project to me. But as easy as it is to mock the hipster dads that put this magazine together and star in its pages, it does seem like the discourse around fatherhood is changing very rapidly, around masculinity in general in this country, and there's not very many places in publishing that are accommodating that.
Mm-hmm. Julia, it seems to me that the creators of this magazine, whose names are David Michael Perez and August Heffner, as far as I can tell from some of the press around them, they hail from Greenpoint, Brooklyn, somewhat predictably. You know, they're most preemptively defensive about that very epithet, hipster fatherhood, right? I mean, they're already answering openly the accusation that that's what this magazine is about and devoted to. And yet it is true. Dana says exactly the right thing, right, which is that we're living through a period of troubled masculinity, or at least ambivalent and ambiguous masculinity. People are looking for models that have previously existed and have all but disappeared. You know, into that large opening, doesn't this come as a relatively narrow niche slice?
Yeah. I mean, this isn't really a magazine about fatherhood. This is a magazine about, and it's not particularly a magazine about privileged fatherhood necessarily. It's a magazine that talks about, in its introductory letter from the editor, appealing to creative artist dads, which is a very specific subset of the American psychographic and the American economy. You know, that said, when you read the magazine, some of the interviews are interesting. It's unusual to see a food blogger, a Japanese-based musician, a furniture maker, and asked intermittently about their work and their home life as a seamless experience. You know, as a editor, one complaint I would have about the magazine is that actually the form of each of the articles is almost too similar. It's kind of long interviews with dads, basically, with a little bit of variation throughout. But it is unusual to hear men questioned about their parenting choices and their work in equal measure. And I was trying to think about how I would feel if I read a bunch of interviews with interesting women that had a similar focus on how they balance their work and home life. It was kind of hard to imagine that magazine.
Mm-hmm. But isn't that every women's magazine?
Yeah.
I mean, this magazine has also taken a lot of mockery for its kind of focus on fashion and the fashion spread of the beautiful dad with his beautiful daughter in the park and, you know, the write-up of everything they're wearing. But doesn't every women's magazine function on that exact same logic, including if you're interviewing, you know, Hillary Clinton or someone who's completely known for their accomplishments in their brain, you still have to talk about what she's wearing and take a nice flattering picture. And so all of that seemed a little bit like sauce for the goose.
Yeah, and it's worth thinking about, well, why was there an entire industry built around selling lifestyles to women, right? Or selling self-images to women before there was a similar one for men, right? And I think it has got to have something to do with just the structure of mid-century living, which was a man gets up in the morning. I do not endorse this as a way of living, believe me, but man gets up in the morning, goes to work, and, you know, brings home the bacon at night, and that's about it. He has got his gray flannel suit or his construction hat or whatever it is, whatever suit of armor he wears for whatever career. It wasn't a lifestyle rooted in the minutiae of consumption choices and domesticity, a lot of time in the home, right? And now we're in another phase. And the new phase is, you know, a lot of men now, I don't know how big a class of men this is in America, but there are increasingly more men who are two things. One, they're members of the creative class who work extremely flexible and geographically portable jobs, right? Or have careers that are extremely freelance, right? And the second is they're determined not to be as remote and or possibly absent as their own fathers were. And they're devoted to the idea of being fathers. You could do worse than create a magazine to fill that vacuum and actually sort of tell someone like, frankly, me, like, what, you know, like what's kind of cool, what to buy, what to do with your kid, you know, how to integrate yourself into a life that's vastly more domestic and way more devoted to spending time with a child, which as someone who became a father now 10 years ago, I just celebrated the 10th anniversary of fatherhood. Like, I was clueless. I had no idea what to do. I have two daughters. Like, I had no idea what to do
with
them.
So
right?
If you had picked
but
up
Steve,
a Kindling Quarterly?
What would you have learned from this magazine? Yeah. I mean, that's the thing that really struck me about the difference between it and its tone and Ladies' Home Journal or Redbook or any of these magazines that sort of take for granted the women reader's role as the mother and manager of the household and then are filled with actual useful advice. This magazine had one single piece of service journalism in it, as far as I could tell. Maybe two if you count the fashion spread, which was a protracted recipe for pumpkin gnocchi that most of the under 13-year-olds of my acquaintance would not have been psyched to eat that pumpkin gnocchi. Perhaps your children are more adventurous than the ones I know. And it was more existential. The tone of the magazine was like, hey, you're a dad. There's other dads out there. We're doing dad stuff.
Yeah, no, listen, I agree with you. First of all, to be absolutely clear, my kids would only eat pumpkin gnocchi if it were embedded at the very bottom of a vat of Annie's mac and cheese. And secondly, like, it's true. Did I learn a lot from this issue of Kindling Quarterly? No, but I mean, now I know that if I want to get the brown low-tough leather tote bag for $750, definitely chocolate brown. It doesn't shoot to the heart of my own experience, but I admire what it's trying.
Well, and one thing we should note, Dana, actually, you mentioned it would be shocking if no one had done this before. And I think in the New York Times squib on the magazine, they interviewed Samar Husni, who's this kind of classic go-to source for all quotes about the magazine industry, who noted the appearance and demise of such magazines as American Dad and other attempts at dad mags. Is the dad mag the new lad mag? anyway, there have been dad mags before, and they are no longer with us. So I wish these Kindling Quarterly guys good luck. I think they could. It could be interesting.
Well, anyway, the magazine is called Kindling Quarterly. It's about, I hate to say it, but it really is about hipster fatherhood. Pick it up, take a look at it, see what you think. All right, moving on to our next topic. In the early 1970s, there was an American folk musician who went by the single name Rodriguez. He made, I'm going to say, a couple three records in the early 70s out of Detroit, which is where he was from, where he'd been living. And those records did absolutely nothing in the American market. They died silently. And to the best of everyone's knowledge, this was the end of the story. Well, lo and behold, according to this extraordinary new documentary, Searching for Sugar Man, which is nominated for the Oscar for Best Documentary, Rodriguez went on to have a creative afterlife in South Africa, which he knew nothing about. In fact, there was some flavor or note or tone to his music that caught the imagination of white liberal South Africans who at the time felt divided and oppressed by apartheid government. And they latched on to Rodriguez as more than a cult figure. In fact, it's several times asserted that he's bigger than Elvis in South Africa, bigger than the Rolling Stones. He became, in effect, a huge rock star and a mythic figure there because there was no information about who this person actually was. It was clear that he had disappeared. And the myth surrounding this figure, known only as Rodriguez, was, I mean, literally all they had to go on was an enigmatic album photo cover of him sitting cross-legged and wearing shades, the name, the songs, and then a myth that had arisen around him that he had killed himself on stage when it was clear that his music was not finding an audience. He either lit himself on fire or blew out his brains after completing a song. The movie effectively is about two or three super obsessed South African fans of Rodriguez in and around the music business who attempt to find out what actually happened to Rodriguez. Why don't we, Dana, before we discuss it, why don't we listen to a clip from this remarkable film?
In the mid-70s, if you walked into a random white liberal middle-class household that had a turntable and a pile of pop records, and if you flipped through the records, you would always see Abbey Road by the Beatles, you'd always see Bridge Over Troubled Water by Simon and Garfunkel, and you would always see Cold Fact by Rodriguez. To us, it was one of the most famous records of all time. The message it had was, be anti-establishment. The one song's called
Dana, are you with me on this? I felt rapture watching this movie, and I'm still glowing from it. I thought it was just absolutely gripping, incredible story, and really fun and really moving. What'd you think?
Yeah, I think, Stephen, that while I was delighted upon my first viewing of the movie, and it's certainly a great story that it tells, and it's great to learn about the existence of Rodriguez and get to hear some of his music, I think there's something about this movie that didn't quite sit right with me. And now that I've read a little bit more about it, I can see what that is. I think it plays pretty fast and loose with the facts in order to tell the inspiring story that it does. One of the facts I think it plays with to some extent is more of an opinion, but is the claim that his music is as great, as rich, as interesting, as varied as Bob Dylan's. I don't really see much in the documentary to bear that out. It seems like he had a very slight, interesting creative output for a brief period. A lot of his songs sound very similar to me, and they sound pretty derivative of Dylan. It's still, of course, interesting to hear about, you know, the Detroitian Mexican-American pseudo Dylan who became a huge hit unbeknownst to himself in South Africa. That's a fantastic story. But I feel like there's some corners being cut in order to tell that story. For example, when they find Rodriguez, which they do, living in essentially kind of abject, almost sort of self-chosen abject poverty in Detroit, it's implied that he hasn't had any relationship to performance or to celebrity for all of these years, the 30-plus years that have elapsed since his big stardom in South Africa in the 70s, when in fact that's not the case at all. Apparently he was known in Australia and had toured in Australia. I think some of his poverty, as I say, was self-chosen. The fact that he was living without a telephone, which made him somewhat harder to find, is something that he chose because he was an odd guy. I think in order to construct this story of themselves rescuing Rodriguez from poverty and obscurity, there are some pretty important things that are left out.
Yeah, my biggest worry in the movie was that, in fact, his celebrity wasn't as big in South Africa as they repeatedly hype it to have been, right? And I actually think the documentary delivers on that.
It makes a very convincing case that people in South Africa are really freaking obsessed with Rodriguez.
And that they turned him into almost a sort of protest singer for their movement.
Yes, exactly.
Right. And the footage, I mean, the most amazing part of the documentary and the thing that I think makes it worth watching, even though I have some of the same misgivings that Dana has about how the story is constructed and a little bit about the music, although I did like it. The footage of his first concert when he returns to South Africa and has as his backing band actually one of the bands who were sort of a protest band his music had originally inspired decades earlier, the reception he gets in this massive arena is just so moving and insane. I mean, it's worth the price of admission just to see that scene itself. It's hilarious and touching and wonderful and, you know, feels like a relic of a pre-globalization era. I mean, obviously, the story is not that simple. The relationship between South Africa and its cultural products and the rest of the world was complicated further by apartheid. But, you know, it's hard to imagine anything like this happening now. It's so easy to find things out about people in a way that it just wasn't 35 years ago.
Yeah, that's one of its major sins of omission, I think, is that this documentary was more about the searching mm-hmm. than it was about the sugar man in a way. I mean, it's relatively easy to find him. I was laughing about this with the person I saw the movie with, sort of saying, like, it's this elaborate story of research and pre-internet detective work and footwork to find the guy. But in fact, it has to be padded out a little bit because he's just sort of living in Detroit mm-hmm. without a phone. He's fairly easy to find. And in fact, his daughter ends up getting in touch with the filmmakers after a website call is put out. Does anybody know where mm-hmm. Rodriguez is? So there's a little bit of drama around that I think is needed as a pacing point for the film, but it doesn't necessarily reflect the reality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Dana, I want to push back on the idea that there's something really fundamentally dishonest about the movie. Not that you've said that, but I don't want people to walk away thinking that's necessarily true. I think this movie is a very, very – it's sort of the dinner party standard of telling the story very well, and you trim and you cut, and there are some – small sins of omission. The one that everyone is apparently pointing to is that he had a tiny, tiny, tiny echo, kind of like little comeback, an attempt at kind of launching him in Australia and New Zealand that really petered out. It was very brief. There were two stabs at it. The one time that he was playing very small venues, he did not sell a lot of records down there, and that kind of took him through the 70s. So, and they just kind of cut that out of the movie. They don't mention that because it makes the dinner party story a little less captivating. I think that that's okay. I don't think it doesn't obscure the central point of the movie, which is that this guy made no money off of his music. He didn't sell a goddamn record in the United States of America. He was doing hard labor in total obscurity and was completely ignorant of the fact that he was a massive, massive rock star in South Africa.
Oh, man. I mean, that just gets to my unending conflicts about documentary, right? Is it journalism or is it a dinner party story? This one's a pretty fun dinner party story, but it does give the journalist in me the queasies.
All right. Well, anyway, we all agree you should go see it, make up your own mind, and then let us know what you think on our Facebook page. The documentary is Searching for Sugarman. It is rentable on iTunes and Amazon.com, and it's nominated for Best Documentary. Well, now is the moment in our show where we endorse. Dana, what do you have?
This week, I'm going to endorse a children's poet named Jack Proletsky. Are you guys familiar with the work of Jack Proletsky? So he's a very prolific children's poet who has, I think, about 20 collections of poetry now. He's been writing, I think, since the 80s or 90s and is still turning things out. My daughter is obsessed with his work. You might compare him to Shel Silverstein and his sort of whimsicality and his rhyme scheme, but I actually like him a lot better than Shel Silverstein. I wish I'd brought in a book so I could read you guys one of his wonderful poems, but a couple of collections that we're particularly obsessed with and that I recommend are Something Big Has Been Here and It's Raining Pigs and Noodles. They're both illustrated by James Stevenson, who completely gets Proletsky's wit, and I think any of his collections would probably be just as excellent.
Mm. Oh, that sounds amazing. Julia, what do you have?
I'm going to recommend a web video. Sorry. That's all I've got for you guys this week. My web video recommendation is, if you have not yet seen the compilation web video of goats yelling like humans, you should watch it immediately. It's really funny. It is what it sounds like. It is goats yelling but sounding like humans. It is the most internet-y thing I've seen. And I was very skeptical when told to watch it and thought, ugh, come on, who needs this? But it turned out I needed it, and I think our listeners do too.
All right. Well, this week I'm going to endorse, oddly enough, I'm going to endorse a thought, though it's going to have a little more context than that, which is that I took my daughters for a kind of, you know, totally trite monument tour of Washington, D.C. This past weekend. And we did all the obvious ones. Totally great. Had a wonderful time. But I had been to the Lincoln Memorial surely a half a dozen times in my life. And it came home to me that I liked the movie Lincoln a lot more than I let on previously, because going to the memorial was a different and more meaningful experience, having seen Daniel Day-Lewis's
Like you saw Daniel Day-Lewis in marble.
It's not that, but the movie brought home how powerful it was to be in the presence of Lincoln, and how informally, and how powerful his formal oratory really was. And so you go in and you read the Gettysburg Address, which are the most remarkable, you know, several hundred words ever publicly uttered, and remained that. And on your right is the second inaugural, reprinted in full in, you know, giant marble. And, you know, you stand and you read both, and it really is a genuinely moving experience. I recommend everybody do it if you get the chance. But it was in reading the second inaugural, kind of with Daniel Day-Lewis's voice. I mean, I'll be cheesy for a minute, with Daniel Day-Lewis's voice in my head. You come across this sentence, and you just it is one of the most remarkable sentences I've ever heard. And so here is the thought. Lincoln asks, "If we shall suppose that American slavery is one of those offenses which, in the providence of God, must needs come, but which, having continued through his appointed time, he now wills to remove, and that he gives to both North and South this terrible war as the woe due to those by whom the offense came, shall we discern therein any departure from those divine attributes which the believers in a living God always ascribe to him?" That is an incredible thought. Absolutely remarkable. I mean, it just what an incredible human being. Anyway, there's my endorsement. All right. Anyway, there we go. Thank you, Dana.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Julia.
Thank you, guys.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about on today's show at wnyc.org/gabfest, where you can also comment on the show. And you'll find the longer podcast versions of our shows in the iTunes store. Just search for Slate Podcasts. Gabfest Radio is a production of Slate.com, which is solely responsible for its content. The producers are Mike Volo and Julia Ferlin. Our interns are Jeff Friedrich and Sally Tamarkin. And the executive producer is Andy Bowers. For everyone in the Gabfest crew, I'm Stephen Metcalf, and we'll see you next week.
Silver magic ships you carry, jumpers, Coke, sweet Mary Jane.